96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM, Channel 141. This is the Insight segment. Your questions or comments, toll free at 855-288-4876. Now, Insight.
Welcome back to The Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM, Channel 141. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. More than a half century ago, that protest song was a rallying cry against racism in America. Back then, racism, segregation, and the violation of one's civil rights was, well, very black and white. But how is racism defined in modern times? We've seen recent examples. Racial harassment of the black student government president at American University, a noose discovered at a middle school in Crofton, Maryland. And those are just a few examples. So how should racism in 2017 be handled? Well, joining us to talk about this are Dr. Greg Carr, chair of the Afro-American Studies Department here at Howard University, and Patrice Sultan, civil rights activist and criminal justice advocate. If you have a question or comment, if you want to get in on this conversation, give us a call. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Follow me on Twitter at HFisherWHUR or at DailyDrumWHUR. Dr. Carr, good to see you. And Patrice, always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Let's talk about 50 years ago, racism, as I said. Black and white examples, literally and figuratively, Dr. Carr, thumbnail sketch of what racism was like in 1957, 1967.
A lot more in your face, for sure. But we had the protective hedge in some ways of segregation. Our communities and institutions were stronger, I think. 50 years ago, it was accepted that we had an uphill battle, but we also had institutional bases to help us organize and move collectively very differently, I think, than now. We just passed the 50th anniversary of the graduating class of 67 here at Howard. And, you know, these are the young people who helped lead the takeover of the administration building that led to the birth of black studies in this country. And, you know, there was a sense of activism, I think, among our young people that we're seeing coming around again, I think, in terms of kind of the cyclical nature of these things. But unlike today, you know, you had stronger, more vibrant black institutions, in part because legal segregation required that of us. I think we live in a post-desegregation era, and that we still haven't solved the question of who we're going to be in this kind of post-civil rights moment.
And from your perspective, Patrice, because we are talking about not only history as it's being made now, but I would imagine, you know, because of your youth, your observations about race and racism are different than perhaps a Dr. Carr or even myself. How would you describe racism in 2017?
Well, what's interesting is that in many ways, the enormity of the criminal justice system is a problem that we didn't see 30 years ago, let alone 50 years ago. And when you look at, for example, D.C. as a microcosm for the rest of the country, if you were to go to dc.gov and look at the statistics for the Department of Youth Rehabilitation Services, you'll see that for the last three fiscal years, it was 96% African-American, then 99% African-American, and most recently 100% African-American. And that's in the city that's the most educated and most progressive in the country. And so in a lot of ways, although we might see fewer instances of harassment, as you alluded to earlier, or fewer instances of hate crime on the basis of race that are widely publicized, there are a lot of indicators of racism that we seem to be ignoring in ways that we might not have tolerated.
Such as
just the size of the system, the criminal justice system itself. It's rare that if I have a student or an intern watching arraignments in C-10, for example, in D.C. Superior Court, that they're there for more than 15 minutes before they say, this looks a lot like slavery. I think that if you were to ask someone who was 10 years younger than me or 20 years younger than me whether they thought it was possible in 2017 to have a system that was entirely black, I think that they would find that surprising and appalling and shocking given where we came from and how far everyone suggests we've come so far.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Racism then, racism now, what's the difference? And how should it be handled? If you have a comment or a question about this topic, give us a call. You know, one of the things that you alluded to, Dr. Carr, was that, you know, say 50 years ago, racism was so much more in your face. But I would imagine, you know, for the very young, at least in pockets, large pockets of the United States, you may have a group of young white kids that have always been exposed to black kids, and that in some way, and I use my daughter for an example because she's now almost 19, but her, while she is aware of racism, her exposure to the kinds of racism that I'm familiar with and that you are familiar with are strikingly different.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, it's interesting. This country, well, put it this way, racism is a structural problem. It's an institutional problem. And over the last 50 years, folks have been able to get from us what they've always gotten from us, our labor, entertainment, these kind of things. It's more readily available now. And, sir, our young people have been deluded, I think, in a lot of ways to believe that things have changed. When, in fact, we just heard, you know, Patrice walked us through the fact that structurally things have not changed. In fact, it's accelerated. But our young people can watch us on television. It isn't now. It's not the old Nat King Cole or when we were coming up, Julia. You know, somebody go watch. It's a black person on television. No, we're all over everywhere now. So it's very entertaining, even as our young people are marched off to the jails and, you know, at the bottom of every category in terms of social economic progress. And so our young people now believe that things have changed when, in fact, in many ways, they've gotten worse. They've gotten worse in terms of black wealth, the black folks who own their homes now. If you look now at the gap, the wealth gap, it's larger now than it was 50 years ago. But what the heck? Because tonight they'll be cheering for John Wall. And, you know, but of course, 50 years ago, they were cheering for Negroes in the NBA as well. It was just not as many of them. And if you ask Adam Jones in Baltimore.
I was about to mention that. Adam Jones, the Baltimore outfielder who went to Boston. And, you know, and certainly Boston has its own very difficult history as it relates to race. And he people were throwing things at him and calling him the N-word while he was, on the field.
Adam Jones, who led the United States team to the World Baseball Classic Championship 3-4 months ago.
Who also just recently donated $20,000 to the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum.
That's right.
in Kansas City. And certainly you were speaking, you know, Patrice, from a legal perspective, but socially and in your own experience and observations, how have you, if you have been confronted with overt or subliminal forms of racism, and how did you deal with that?
You know, I think the sporting example and the television examples are interesting insofar as when you have a critical mass of whites versus or vis-a-vis African Americans, the dynamic is very different in terms of the hostility that you're confronted with. So if we were to look, for example, I know we talked earlier off the air about the show Black-ish, for example.
Yes.
If you were to compare Black-ish with a show like The Cosby Show, for example, there's a very different dynamic when you're talking about a young black family that happens to be wealthy where their kids are still going to schools that are predominantly black versus sort of the premise of The Black-ish show where you have kids who are surrounded by white kids. And I think that you see sort of that same dynamic at American University and at Maryland and in Boston when you have players of color who are being treated that way. And so I think that certainly plays a role. And even though we communicate in a way where things feel like we're more connected in some sense, there's still a real energy that comes from being like the sole person who looks a certain way in a group versus having that critical mass there of other people who look like you.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Racism then, racism now. What's the difference and how should it be handled? Have you, our listeners, experienced recently a form of racism? And if you have, we'd like to hear about it, but we'd also like to hear how you handled it. That's interesting. I'd like to hear that story. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. And to that point, Dr. Carr, handling it as an institution or as a social ill is certainly different than one may handle it as an individual if you are confronted with, you know, racism.
Absolutely. Our people make a fundamental mistake. We confuse racial prejudice with the structural function of white supremacy. And I love that example of the Cosby Show. The Cosby Show kind of sits midway between 50 years ago and now. And of course, that iteration of our entertainment was still anchored in black institutions. So you see, the spinoff, of course, becomes a different world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, let's contrast that with Blackish. When the oldest daughter now is going to college, she's going to the white school. And there was some pushback on social media. Oh, they should have sent her to an HBCU. Yeah, them days is gone because the sensibility has shifted now. Our people have gone for the okey-doke. The American narrative is not only fundamentally a myth, the myth of racial progress. That myth then feeds the weakening of black institutions. So the institutional thrust of a Bill Cosby, of an Alvin Poussaint, the thrust of a Debbie Allen to talk about how we move as a group has dissolved into this chimera, this myth that somehow individuals making progress is a marker for the group making progress. So, yeah, now it's like, you know, the goal is to get you a nice house and bring pops in and your mom. And that's why I think it was brilliant for them to put that ISH on the end mm-hmm. of that show. It is black-ish. It ain't black.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We're talking about racism then, racism now, how you would handle it. How should it be dealt with? Let's go to Hanson, calling from D.C.
Hassan, maybe.
Hassan?
Yes, that's me.
Okay, thank you so much. Forgive me. What's on your mind?
Well, about a few weeks ago, I had went to the liquor store, and it was a young brother that was first security at the liquor store. Mm-hmm. And I had just walked over to his car, gave him a $5, and by the time I had my car was parked right next to his, three white officers had guns drawn in my face. My brother was with me as well. They drew weapons on him, slammed us on the ground, and they said, well, he had been called. Someone called and said he had a gun and so forth. The guy that was parked next to me, who was actually security to the liquor store. As they did the investigation, they didn't find any weapon or any drugs on the guy. And as I told him, I was like, you know, because I'm a black male, you feel it's okay to hop out of your vehicle with your weapon drawn without even speaking to me. And I'm like, you know, if you accidentally pull the trigger or anything and kill me, my life is taken in vain because you don't value my life as a black man if you think it's okay to do such a thing. Because at the end of the day, like I said to him, he didn't have any right to draw weapons on me. I was not ever included in his investigation, you know, so-called investigational phone call. Mm-hmm. All you did was see me walk over there and shake the guy's hand and then go back to my car.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, like I was telling her, I have many incidents like that where I could, and someone could say, well, that's not racism, but it is. You know, because, and then after it took place, the white officers were very disrespectful and trying to speak to them and reason with them about, you know, what just took place. Won't use the N-word, but mm-hmm. you need to be quiet, nigga. You don't have no place to tell me anything. I do how I want to do you at any time, any day.
Well, Hassan, thank you so much for sharing that with me. I need to take a break, but I want my guest to address that on the other side, because suffice it to say, Hassan's story is not unique. And you know, it reminds me of the Alton Sterling situation in Baton Rouge. The difference is Alton Sterling did not survive that encounter, and Hassan did, and we're glad that he is with us to tell that tale. We're going to get your reaction to Hassan's story in just a few seconds. We're also going to talk to Mike, calling from D.C., George in D.C., Renee in D.C., and Mason also from D.C. Stay with us. Do not hang up. You will be able to hear the program, and we will get to your phone call in just a bit at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking about racism then, racism now, what's the difference, and how it should be handled, how it should be addressed. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Jeff Brown is next with the original Quiet Storm on 96.3 WHUR. We'll be back in just a few seconds. The Howard University.